welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. It is Tuesday, January 26th. I'm your reader, Kathleen. On the front page of the Gazette today, GOP lawmakers advance school choice bills. Republican lawmakers who control the Iowa legislature pressed ahead Monday with plans to expand school choice for parents with public funds for private and charter schools, and with requiring K-12 schools to offer an in-person instruction option as the state struggles through the pandemic. This is a huge day for students and parents as well, said Senator Brad Zahn, Republican from Urbandale, on a day the Senate and Education Committee passed Senate Study Bill 1064 and Senate Study Bill 1065. However, representatives from education groups joined parents, epidemiology experts, and Democratic lawmakers in trying to slow down a fast-track process of requiring 100% in-person classes for families who choose it, at least until school staffs could be vaccinated against COVID-19 and more mitigation measures were in place. I really think we should slow this process down to allow awareness to build, to allow the details to be examined more carefully, and really to take the full measure of this, said Senator Herman Kornbach, Democrat from Ames, ranking member of the Senate Education Committee, which nonetheless advanced two of Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' priorities on party lines. The measure would enact the full-time, in-person required option in February for the remainder of the school year, and according to an Iowa State Education Association estimate, start the process of funding a $50 million first step in a plan to earmark taxpayer money for students' private school tuition. The governor's office projects the initial cost to be about $3 million. Senator Amy Sinclair, Republican from Ellerton, chair of the Senate Education Committee, said the legislative pace would give Iowans enough time to provide their input while also addressing concerns many lawmakers said they heard while campaigning that student achievement is suffering as children learn virtually or in a hybrid combination of online and in-person classes. School choice shouldn't be about politics. It should be about making the right decisions for students in the right places and at the right time, Sinclair told a subcommittee meeting. We're talking about giving back to parents the right to hold accountable the systems that are in place for their child's education, she added. How dare we say we know better than parents? One way to achieve that end, said Zahn, would be to open up Iowa's education system to allow parents to enroll their children in the schools of their choice. This gives parents the choice to decide what's the best school in their area, public or non-public. You should not have to go to school based on what your zip code is, Zahn said of SSB 1065, which passed committee on an 8-7 vote. Critics said the bill would siphon away taxpayer money meant to improve education for nearly 500,000 children to benefit a small fraction taking advantage of the limited scholarships to attend private or charter schools with little public oversight. This is a slippery slope to a full-scale voucher program that has happened in other states, said Phil Jennery, Government Relations Director of the Iowa Association of School Boards. Pete McRoberts of the ACLU of Iowa and Betty Andrews of the NAACP raised legal concerns about provisions of SSB 1065 that could jeopardize equality and diversity. Andrews requested a minority impact statement be considered. Opponents expressed concern the proposal was drafted without input from public school districts and would change athletic eligibility standards and lift open enrollment caps for 5 districts under anti-discriminatory diversity requirements. It's the wrong public policy for Iowa and an inappropriate use of public tax dollars. Vouchers represent a rural to urban shift in resources, said Jesse Howard, a New London school board member. As one parent told me last weekend, this bill is going to create the Wild West of public education and will be the death of what we look at for quality education. Public dollars should stay with public schools. Reynolds' bill proposes 3 elements of school choice by establishing state funding for students in struggling public schools who wish to attend a private school, creating a charter program, and allowing students to transfer out of schools with voluntary or court-ordered diversity plans. Chuck Hurley of the Family Leader urged legislators to consider facts, not fear, in supporting a school choice approach he said has improved academic outcomes. Children should not be forced to fail because the state ties them to a school that's failing, he said. Reynolds' bill proposes a state-funded Student First scholarship program that would be available for any students at public schools that are receiving support under the federal Every Student Succeeds Act. The bill also creates a program for charter schools that are exempt from most state education regulations and creates a mechanism by which students in districts with diversity programs can transfer out. If you have a problem school, the solution is to fix the problem school, said Kornbach. But Senator Jim Carlin, Republican of Sioux City, countered, "We're not sticking with status quo when status quo is failing." In approving SSB 1064 by a 10-5 vote, senators voted to require Iowa's public and non-public schools to provide a 100% in-person instruction option for parents and students, but still allow a waiver process through the State Department of Education in case a district is hit with a viral outbreak. If approved by the legislature and signed by the governor, the measure would take effect within roughly 2 weeks. Parents and students would be given a period of time to decide what kind of instruction they wish to receive, according to the legislation. Lobbyists for school organizations expressed concern the legislation was superseding local decisions on staffing demands and other issues with an unfunded state mandate that requires educators to essentially offer three separate plans of instruction: in-person, hybrid, and online learning. However, Representative Garrett Gobble, Republican from Ankeny, rebutted claims the bill was a power grab of local control. He said the action was being taken because the state was in danger of punting this school year away if students were not able to return to the classroom for person-to-person instruction. Reynolds, during an interview last week, said a majority of Iowa school districts have managed to provide full-time in-person instruction. The data just doesn't support the fear, the governor said. In another front-page story, vaccines are cleared for those 65 in Linn County. This story is by Michaela Ram for the Gazette. Linn County residents 65 and older can begin receiving a COVID-19 vaccine on a very limited basis starting today, county public health officials announced. Residents interested in getting a shot must schedule an appointment, but officials warn appointments will fill up quickly. Residents who qualify will be contacted by their primary care provider to schedule an appointment to receive the first shot of a vaccine for the novel coronavirus. Providers who will administer these shots include those associated with Mercy Care Clinics and Unity Point Health Clinics, and several independent health care contractors. Those who do not have a primary care provider will be assisted by Linn County Public Health. They should call 319-892-6097. It's unknown when Johnson County will begin administering vaccines to this group. County public health officials told the Gazette that the public should expect information sometime this week. Linn County Public Health will have only 800 doses of the vaccine on hand this week, a fraction of our population that's 65 and older, said Heather Meter, Clinical Services Supervisor at Linn County Public Health. Because of that, it may be some time before some residents get an appointment. We ask our community to be patient as we all work to vaccinate as many individuals as possible, given the vaccine availability. Additional appointments will open as more vaccine becomes available, officials said in a news release. People should not call their doctor's office to request a vaccine because a high volume of calls will make it difficult for those providers to address patients with the most immediate needs, officials said. Meter noted there is no waiting list or registry for people to sign up to receive vaccine at this time. Iowans 65 and older qualify for a COVID-19 vaccine under Phase 1B of the state's vaccine distribution plan and can receive a shot at any stage during the rollout, Governor Kim Reynolds announced last week. Linn County officials said they will begin administering vaccines to essential workers and other at-risk populations that qualify under Phase 1B on February 1. Priority for Phase 1B populations outside of those 65 and older are broken into five tiers, starting with first responders, pre-K-12 school staff, early childhood education and child care workers. Meter said 50% of the county's vaccine allocation will go to the first tier. The remaining four tiers under Iowa's Phase 1B plan are food distribution and manufacturing workers in congregate settings, as well as people with disabilities in home settings and their caregivers, staff and residents of congregate settings and government officials, health, life, and safety inspectors, and correctional facility staff and inmates. The effort to vaccinate under Phase 1A, which includes frontline healthcare workers and long-term care facility staff and residents, still is underway. Earlier this month, Meter said it would take months to vaccinate people who qualify under Phase 1A and 1B based on the current vaccine supply. The state currently receives about 19,500 doses per week. More than 660,000 Iowans qualified under Phase 1B, according to state estimates. As people wait for their vaccine, Meter said Linn County Public Health recommends residents take stricter measures to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. New recommendations include limiting interactions with non-household members and limiting social gatherings to 25 people or less, or to 25% of the room capacity. Meter said bars and restaurants should limit capacity to 50% and to allow seating or ordering at the bar. Other businesses should encourage employees to work from home if they can. More information about the COVID-19 vaccine effort in Linn County can be found on the Public Health Department's website, lynncounty.org/1372/COVID-19. And again, that number to call at Linn County Public Health is 319-892-6097. Our final front page story by Vanessa Miller, UI workers differ on value of diversity efforts. A University of Iowa survey released Monday exposes campus divisions, perhaps mirroring rifts nationally, with some minority employees reporting bias and intimidation, while others express concerns the UI talks too much about diversity issues. With 86% of residents reported that the University of Iowa has a strong commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion, 31% of respondents reported that there is too much emphasis put on issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, according to the 2020 Campus Climate Survey. The survey was distributed in September and October to 19,339 faculty, staff, and postdoctoral scholars. About 38% of those, or 7,412, replied, with the highest responding group being professional and scientific staff, 4,013, or 53%, followed by faculty at 1,212, or 41%, and then smaller groups. The survey comes 2 years after the UI last polled its employees about diversity issues and after years of diversity-related staff turnover, including atop the campus's diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. It also follows a summer of racial reckoning nationally and locally, with protesters converging on the UI campus following George Floyd's killing by Minneapolis police. Those protests prompted both Iowa City and UI officials to vow changes in their diversity efforts and actions, plans the UI updated Monday with its release of the survey findings, including mandating more training, creating new diversity assignments, and designating $500,000 for diversity, equity, and inclusion work. These are significant challenges, not just at Iowa, but across the country, according to Liz Tovar, Interim UI Associate Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. The solutions for these issues require listening, followed by action, It takes time, and Iowa is approaching these issues to develop long-lasting culture rather than short-term responses. Although the campus surveyed from 2 years ago included both employees and students, the 2020 edition didn't involve UI undergraduate, graduate, or professional students. The campus will administer a student experience in the Research University survey this spring, according to its Office of Strategic Communication. Moving to the Iowa Today page, an Iowa Appeals Court Chief Judge is chosen to serve the second term. The Iowa Court of Appeals has selected Judge Thomas Bauer as Chief Judge for second 2-year term, court officials announced on Monday. Bowers of Cedar Falls was selected as Chief at the Appeals Court's first meeting. A Chief is selected in each odd-numbered year by a majority vote to serve a 2-year term. Bauer has served on the Appeals Court since 2012 and was first elected as Chief in 2019 when Chief Judge Gail Nelson Vogel retired. Bauer received his law degree at Drake University in 1987. He was appointed to the District Associate Court in 1993 and the District Court Bench in 1995. He was appointed Chief Judge of the First Judicial District Court in 2010. Before his appointment on the bench, he served as an Ames Assistant City Attorney and an Assistant Blackhawk County Attorney. He helped establish the Blackhawk County Adult Drug Court Program in 2006 and a Mental Health Court Program in 2009. The Iowa Court of Appeals is a 9-member intermediate appellate court. It reviews appeals from trial court that are transferred by the Iowa Supreme Court. In addition to day-to-day judicial duties, the Chief Judge supervises court business and serves on the Judicial Council. In other Today news, this by Kat Russell. A 52-year-old woman who reportedly fell Thursday at Geneva Tower in downtown Cedar Rapids has died, police said. Emergency responders were called just before 10 a.m. to an apartment at 310 Fifth Avenue Southeast. They found Shelley Lang unconscious with serious traumatic injuries, the Cedar Rapids Police Department said. Lang was taken to University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics where she died Saturday. Police said an autopsy was scheduled for Monday. The police department said the investigation into the circumstances of the alleged fall, including how the victim sustained injuries, is ongoing. In another Iowa Today story, Blanick murder trial delayed. This story is by Trish Mahaffey for the Gazette. A judge ruled Monday that the trial for a man accused of killing Chris Bagley of Walker in 2018 will be delayed to allow the defense more time to further review evidence, some of which was received late and may require additional expert witnesses. Leon Spies, an Iowa City lawyer representing Drew Blanick, who is charged with first-degree murder earlier Monday, argued during a hearing that they received important lab results of evidence late, and experts he has consulted said they cannot review the materials and form opinions before February 16, when the trial was set to begin in Linn County District Court. About a week and a half ago, the defense team received 6 new lab reports on fabric and upholstery of a vehicle belonging to Drew Wagner, a co-defendant convicted in the case, which contained male DNA and testing of knives and knife sheaths found in Blanick's apartment, Spies said. Spies noted that he wasn't blaming the prosecution. Linn County Attorney Jerry VanderSanden, in his argument against delaying the trial, said the defense hasn't shown a good and compelling cause to delay the trial, which is required. He said the defendant's motion should be viewed in the light of the defense being raised. Blanick is claiming self-defense and defense of another, which is an affirmative defense, essentially acknowledging that he committed the act while claiming he was justified. The scientific test results that will be offered at trial are summarized in the minutes of testimony filed January 7, over a month before the trial, VanderSanden noted. The reports those minutes are based upon previously were disclosed to the defendant. FBI reports dated July 31 and September 26 of 2019 describing the DNA testing and fingerprint examinations were given to Spies with the bulk of other evidence on January 3, 2020, the prosecutor said. The lab results of the DNA testing of the knife sheaths were provided to the defense July 9, 2020, VanderSanden said. The additional FBI reports were provided as soon as the prosecution received them. However, these reports didn't disclose any consequential scientific conclusions. Testing of the defendant's two knives and sheaths showed no discernible results, he said. Van der Sanden said the physical evidence didn't tell us anything we didn't already know. Spies said he thinks the defense will present a different interpretation of the evidence, and it's critical to have it reviewed. They don't know the underlying data for the testing, and they still are missing an additional six lab reports, he said. Sixth Judicial District Judge Christopher Bruns said he found there is good and compelling cause to reset the trial to allow the defendant the opportunity to develop evidence from the additional information to help bolster his own credibility or undermine the credibility of the state's witnesses. The trial will be reset at a later date. Blanik, age 33, also was charged with abuse of a corpse and obstruction of prosecution. Wagner, age 35, of Cedar Rapids, pleaded in June to amended charges of voluntary manslaughter, assault while participating in a felony, conspiracy to commit a forcible felony, abuse of a corpse, and obstruction of prosecution in Bagley's death. During his plea hearing, he admitted to starting a fight with Bagley for robbing their drug dealer, Andrew Shaw, of Cedar Rapids, who has been convicted in federal court. Wagner said he held Bagley down while Blanik repeatedly stabbed him. Wagner also said he and Blanik buried Bagley, age 31, who went missing December 4, 2018, in a yard of a southeast Cedar Rapids home where Wagner was living at the time. Bagley's body was excavated on March 1, 2019. Wagner faces up to 37 years in prison. He likely will be sentenced after testifying against Blanik. Paul Hoff, age 41, of Cedar Rapids, already sentenced in federal court to 14 years for firearms and drugs violation, is charged with abuse of a corpse and obstruction of prosecution. He is being tried separately. Moving now to the Insight page, the editorial today is a reprint from Sunday's Washington Post, and the editorial is titled, "Biden Hasn't Renounced Unity." President Joe Biden used his inaugural speech to issue a stirring call to unity. Then he signed a series of executive orders on climate change, LGBTQ rights, racial disparities, and other controversial issues. For some critics, this was a contradiction. President Biden promised unity, Senator Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, tweeted, but his first action was to kill jobs. In fact, there was no contradiction. In the United States, unity does not mean that one side gets everything it wants. In a pluralistic democracy, unity is the most elusive of things, Biden said in his speech, because policy disagreement is at the core of the system. The president bears no more responsibility to surrender his principles on entering the Oval Office than Cotton does sitting in the Senate. Both men promised to represent voters' beliefs on the national stage, and both should try to advance them. It is in the manner of trying where unity can be found in a democracy, unity of a democratic values, purpose, and process. The nation's political system is designed to manage and channel disagreement peacefully and ideally with a level of respect and decorum. That system ensures that no one gets everything they want and everyone has a fair chance to appeal to the people. Unity in such a system requires first that the actors within it recognize that one can disagree in good faith. Those with different views are not the enemy of the people. Second, unity requires that politicians prioritize achieving things for the country over ruining their political opponents. Third, it requires respect for the process. Leaders should refrain from abusing the system to rout the other side. Biden appears to be teeing up big initiatives that should appeal to many Republicans if they intend to meet the president's calls for unity with good faith. These include further COVID-19 relief, historic reinvestment in U.S. infrastructure, and bipartisan immigration reform. Republicans will feel pressure to deny Biden wins of any kind and to paint his agenda as radical. Their party spent 4 years indulging and enabling President Donald Trump, who at every turn sought to divide the country for political gain. their sudden demands for community ring as cynical and self-serving. Republicans should allow Biden to exercise the usual powers of the presidency without accusations that he is promoting disunity by advancing policies he campaigned on. They can note principled disagreements without resorting to divisive invective. That's what unity is in a democracy. That's what it should look like. Again, that was a reprint from the Washington Post. And At Liberty by Adam Solomon today, appetite for the Patriot Party in Iowa. Before he flew away from the Capitol, former President Donald Trump vowed, "We will be back in some form." The one-term president has said he may run for the job again in 2024, and he appears to be the early front-runner. Allies serving as anonymous sources to the news media say Trump is exploring the possibility of launching a new political movement to be dubbed the Patriot Party and aimed at challenging his few Republican detractors. Trump remains extremely popular among Iowa Republicans. They delivered him an 8-point victory in the state last November, and party activists this month unanimously re-elected their boisterously pro-Trump chairman, Jeff Kaufman. He recently said Trump was still has a great deal of support in this state. But there are cracks in the foundation. All five of Iowa's federally elected Republicans voted this month to formalize the election results, showing President Joe Biden won. That prompted backlash from rank-and-file Republicans who hoped Congress would challenge the results. The Iowa GOP grassroots are interested in the prospect of a splinter party, and some are using the GOP infrastructure to make plans. In an email to members after the presidential election results were certified, one county GOP chairman openly floated the idea of an alternative party, calling Iowa's elected Republicans spineless and Republicans in name only. "I have heard it put this way. We have two options. A, rebuild the Republican Party and replace the spineless rhinos with genuine patriots, or B, start a new party that is capable of competing with the Republican and Democratic parties," the county chairman wrote. Their refusal to compromise might be admirable, if only were it in service to something valuable. Trump and his loyalists got everything they wanted from the Republican Party. It became purely a vehicle for promoting and preserving Trump. Voters and elected officials abandoned long-held conservative values like free trade, limited spending, and free market health care reform. They got almost everything they wanted, that is, the vice president, most Republican senators, and about a third of Republican representatives finally broke ranks when Trump asked them to throw out legitimate election results and fomented a riot at the Capitol. Trump controlled the party in every way except that, and it wasn't enough, so he's taking his movement and going elsewhere. It's not clear yet whether this will be a real alternative party, like the Reform Party formed by Ross Perot in the 1990s, or more of a branding strategy like the Tea Party movement from the Obama era. It could be both. Trump's followers could run as either Republicans or patriots, depending on political factors and election procedures in their states and districts. They are likely to encounter some electoral booby traps along the way. State governments make it difficult for third-party candidates to get on the ballot. As Trump publicly fretted about libertarians siphoning off his votes, Iowa Republicans in the past 4 years have imposed new regulations to stifle third-party competition. They are barriers erected in part to protect Trump. Now they may stand in his way. One community letter to the editor today: lawmakers skipping forums frustrates constituent. It's time to address the elephant in the room, or maybe the missing elephant in the room. On January 23, Linn County League of Women Voters, a nonpartisan organization, held its first legislative forum via video conference. All Linn County lawmakers were in attendance except for two. My Republican lawmakers did not attend. This has become predictable for State Senator Dan Zumbach, who rarely, if ever, attends forums. However, this was the first forum for newly elected State Representative Charlie McClintock, I was surprised and dismayed he was not in attendance. Because of the lack of a mask policy at the State House, many will not travel to Des Moines to speak with lawmakers about important legislation, myself included. When they refuse to attend local events, I am unable to exercise my right to petition my government. Republicans are proposing 2 constitutional amendments this session and sweeping changes to public education. Forums allow constituents to see all electeds answer the same questions about the same issues in real time. This is an important part of clear and transparent government. I sincerely hope our 2 legislators attend future forums and recognize that their work as elected doesn't end with an election. That's when the real work of listening to their constituents begins. And that letter is signed by Mary Burke. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Tuesday, January 26th on IRIS. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices from Anamosa, Shelley Ray Lang, age 52, died Saturday, January 23. Kramer Funeral Home, Monticello. In Cedar Rapids, Larry G. Sedrell, age 84, died Monday, January 25. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. Also in Cedar Rapids, Terry Lee West Smith, age 64, died Sunday, January 24. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. In Decorah, Donald O. Johnson, age 88, died Thursday, January 21st. Fielstow Funeral Home, Decorah. In Fairfax, Robert Carson, age 85, died Sunday, January 24. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. In Montour, Elmer, known as Fudd, Roberts Jr., Mitwiya, age 66, died Monday, January 25th, Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. And in Spillville, Lance Spiral, age 76, died Monday, January 25. Schluter Ballack Funeral Home in Decorah is in charge. Moving to the regular notices, from Marion, Lester Peter, known as Pete Jurgens, age 80, of Marion, formerly of Van Horn, passed away at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, January 24th. The family will greet friends from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, the 28th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, the 29th, at St. Paul's Lutheran, 915 27th Street in Marion. Burial will follow at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. From Cedar Rapids, Dorothy Pauline Howard, age 97, passed away January 22nd. Private services and interment for Dorothy will be held for immediate family at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home and Cemetery. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website under the obituary for Pauline Howard under the video tab. Starting at 1 p.m. Friday, January 29, a celebration of life service for friends and extended family will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories at a later date to be determined. From Cedar Rapids, Ruth L. Fox passed away January 21st. Ruth will be interred in Gowrie, Iowa at a later date. Donations may be directed to Iowa Ceramics Center and Glass Studio in memory of Ruth Fox. From Cedar Rapids, Bobby Jean Filer, age 89, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Birmingham, Iowa, passed away Friday, January 22nd at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. A graveside service will begin at 11 a.m. Thursday, the 28th, at Maple Hill Cemetery in Birmingham. Friends may leave condolences online at the CranstonFamilyFuneralHome.com. From Cedar Rapids, Philip J. McCurdy, age 66, died Friday, January 22nd. Visitation will be from 1 to 7 on Thursday, January 28th at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. Private family funeral mass will be at 10 a.m. Friday the 29th with burial to follow at St. Patrick's Cemetery in Fairfax. Friends and extended family are invited to watch the mass via live stream. Please find the live stream link on Phil's tribute wall and share your support and memory with his family at stuartbaxter.com. From Cedar Rapids, Mark L. Wiltsey, age 73, died at the University of Iowa hospitals after losing his battle with cancer. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. IowaCremation.com is a website where you can leave condolences. From Clarence, Merle C. Edler, age 97, of Clarence, passed away Sunday the 24th at the Clarence Nursing Home. Private family services will be held at St. John's United Church of Christ in Clarence with the Reverend Matt Schneider Adams officiating. Burial will follow at St. John's Cemetery in Clarence. From Ankeny, Arnold, known as Arnie Jerome Sund, age 80, of Ankeny, passed away at Taylor House Hospice on Thursday, January 21st. It was Arnold's request that no services be held. Please direct all memorials to the American Cancer Society. Online condolences can be left at www.ankenyfuneralhome.com. From Clarence, Barbara Mooney's services for Tuesday the 26th have been postponed to Wednesday, January 27, due to the weather. Again, that notice is a postponement for services for Barbara Mooney. Chapman Funeral Home is in charge. From Covington, Lester Stufen, age 90, passed away Sunday, January 24th, in his home. Public visitation will be from 4 to 7 on Thursday, January 28, at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Private family interment with military rites will be in Cedar Memorial Cemetery. From Oxford Junction, Betsy Ann Bonney passed away Saturday, January 23, after a short illness. Her funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, January 30th, at the Dawson Funeral Services in Oxford Junction. A visitation will be held from 3 to 6 Friday, January 29, at the funeral home. Burial will be held at Mayflower Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Oxford Junction Volunteer Fire Department and ambulance. From Loudoun, Donald H. Cromer, age 82, passed away Sunday, January 24, at Unity Point Health St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 30th, at Trinity Lutheran Church in Loudoun, with the Reverend Daniel Redage officiating. Burial will follow at Trinity Lutheran Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 Friday, January 29th, at the church. Chapman Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Marion, Carol Ann Sawyer passed away Saturday, January 23, at the age of 77. Beloved mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, sister, aunt, and friend. Donations are to be made to St. Jude's Children Research Hospital in lieu of flowers. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. In Waukee, Philip Kuhn passed away January 21, surrounded by family. In lieu of flowers, Phil would want you to pay your kindness forward in his memory. Call someone you miss, donate to your favorite charity, or pick up the bill for someone behind you in the coffee line and think of him. Funeral services at St. Francis of Assisi in West Des Moines are pending. He will be interred at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery. In Olwine, Linda J. Souls Meyer, age 73, passed away Saturday, January 23, at the Olwine Healthcare Center. Funeral service will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, January 29, at Peace Lutheran Church, Olwine. Visitation will be from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. Thursday at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home, Olwine, and 1 hour before the service Friday at the church. Interment will be at the Woodlawn Cemetery, Olwine. A memorial fund has been established for Peace Lutheran Church and Paralyzed Veterans of America. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home is in charge. And lastly, from Greeley, Colorado, Ronald Rodney Lavelle, age 79, passed away January 5. Moving now to the sports page, this story by K.J. Pilcher for the Gazette. Girls State Wrestling takes big step. The third installment of the Iowa Wrestling Coaches and Officials Association's Girls State Tournament was bigger and better than ever, moving from Waverly Shell Rock High School to Xtreme Arena in Coralville. The expansion has been well documented. The tournament began two seasons ago, featuring 87 competitors. Last season, it blossomed to 250. This weekend consisted of 457 wrestlers in the two-day event. The time there was more pomp and circumstance, similar treatment as their male counterparts. They wrestled in a larger venue, six mats under the bright venue of lights Saturday, large screens on display. They even had a large backdrop that served as background for the awards podium. Iowa Valley's Millie Peach was one of the original champions in 2019. She became the first three-time champion, pinning her way through the tournament again. During the inaugural event, Peach said she hoped one day this would be held in Wells Fargo Arena like the boys' tournament. "I think this is definitely a big step in getting here," Peach said. "This is an arena now, and that's a very big step." The tournament was filled with memorable moments, including a rousing speech from Iowa legend Dan Gable, who noted that female wrestling has helped save the sport's Olympic status. Titles were spread out to 9 different schools, and 16 total schools were represented in the finals. There were also lump-in-the-throat moments that may have tug-at-heartstrings-type feeling, like when Charles City's Lily Luft pointed upward after winning her 126-pound title to acknowledge her late brother Logan, who died from an ATV accident in 2017. Don't forget Samantha Spielbauer at 160 pounds, winning Clayton Ridge's first individual state title in wrestling. The tournament was a shining example of how far the girls' wrestling movement has come. More work still is needed to become sanctioned. And in another sports story, Iowa throttled Minnesota 35-4 in its second Big Ten Conference duel. The Gophers program is a shell of itself. The Hawkeyes are also soaring like many thought, but their dominance is mind-boggling. And it starts with Spencer Lee. He worked over Patrick McKee, who was ranked 9th. He led 14-0 in the first period when he used a bar arm and a half to put McKee on his back. Had he gotten the fall in 153, it would have been an 18-0 technical. In sports events of area interest today, girls basketball, Prairie is at City High, Western Dubuque's at Washington, Mount Vernon's at Marion, Waterloo West is at Xavier, Dubuque Hempstead plays at Kennedy, Dubuque Wallert plays at Linmar, Cedar Falls is at Liberty, Waterloo East is at Iowa City West, Mid Prairie is at Regina, and Jefferson is at Dubuque Senior. In boys basketball, today, City High plays at Prairie. Dubuque Senior is at Jefferson. Mid Prairie's at Regina. Marion is at Mount Vernon. Washington plays at Western Dubuque. Kennedy is at Dubuque Hempstead. Linmar plays at Dubuque Wallert. Iowa City West at Waterloo East. Liberty at Cedar Falls. And in high school wrestling, Linmar Midland at Cascade. That is at 5:30. Moving now to the Business 380 page for the Gazette. This story is by John Steppe. Delta is to resume nonstop route to Atlanta. Delta Airlines will resume its daily nonstop service between the Eastern Iowa Airport and Atlanta on March 2. Airport Director Marty Lenz told the Airport Commission Monday the airline will have one flight to and from Atlanta for now. Delta usually had two daily flights between Cedar Rapids and Atlanta before the pandemic. The flight will depart from Cedar Rapids at 6:50 a.m. local time and arrive in Atlanta at 10:10 Eastern time. The return service will depart at Atlanta at 8:30 p.m. and arrive at Cedar Rapids at 10. It will be a 76-seat regional jet instead of the 110-seat Boeing 717, which was previously used on the Cedar Rapids-Atlanta route. With reintroduction of the Atlanta nonstop flight, all 15 of the Cedar Rapids Airport's nonstops will be operational. Delta also has nonstop flights to Detroit and Minneapolis. In another Business 380 story, cable and internet costs are rising. Even cord cutters will take a hit. This story is actually a reprint from the Pittsburgh Post Cable TV and internet customers will owe Comcast an extra $78 this year due to a price hike that went into effect this month. AT&T recently upped the price for its DirecTV satellite service, adding another $108 to customer bills. Hulu just jacked up its price by $10 a month, although many of its customers are families who switched to the streaming service to cut the cord from high-priced cable TV companies. Other popular video-on-demand services like Netflix and Disney also will charge more this year. The timing of the price increases couldn't be worse for millions of Americans out of work, stuck at home, and struggling to keep up with bills. But big media companies put the blame on the ever-rising cost of programming, most noticeably for broadcast TV and sports, which are the biggest factors driving the price hikes that get passed down to consumers. It's always more about inflation. They do it every January, and there's absolutely nothing we can do to stop this, said Mark Cooper, Director of Research at the Consumer Federation of America in Washington, D.C. Price hikes for cable TV and internet service practically have become an annual tradition over the past two decades. Households are paying more to watch their favorite TV shows, and a recent report by DecisionData.org illustrates it with a sobering conclusion. Using publicly available data from municipal utility providers and other sources, the Home Services Comparison website found that the average household cable bill of $217 a month exceeds what most families spend on other utilities combined. Cable bills stay relatively similar across household sizes, whether it's one person living in a small apartment or a family of 10 in a large house. It's normal for the average consumer to look for ways to save money on things like their electric or water bills through conservation efforts, the report said. But what we still don't hear discussed more frequently is how to cut costs on what is becoming every household's biggest utility bill. It's not as if cable is optional anymore, with having internet access at home being almost as important as electricity. Cable companies point to rising fees they pay to carry TV networks. Networks like ABC, Disney, and ESPN require cable and satellite TV and streaming services such as Hulu to pay for the rights to carry their channels. The networks have their own rising costs, and the big media companies that own the TV networks are faced with higher price tags for creating and producing content. The final season of HBO's Game of Thrones cost parent company Warner Media $15 million per episode, in the neighborhood of a movie budget. The Television Viewers Protection Act, which went into effect this month, requires cable TV service providers to give customers an itemized breakdown of extra fees and charges, as well as a good faith estimate of the taxes that will be collected by the cable provider. In some Eastern Iowa briefs, Saturday night free fundraiser concert to be live streamed. This Saturday, help others affected by COVID-19 while jamming out with the pork tornadoes from the comfort and safety of your own home. North Liberty's Beat the Bitter Igloo Jam, presented by Green State Credit Union, is partnering with United Way of Johnson and Washington Counties for this virtual blast on Saturday. This event is free to attend as a live stream concert and is a fundraiser for United Way's Community Disaster Relief Fund, currently focused on ensuring that individuals and families have the support to weather the short and long-term impacts of the coronavirus outbreak. The concert starts at 8 p.m. Saturday. Free tickets are available at beatthebitter.com/event/igloojamcovidreliefconcert. When registering for the event, you'll be invited to make a donation to the United Way Community Relief Fund. In Center Junction, sign up for Saturday's family snowshoeing event. Need to get your kids out of the house for some screen-free time? Take advantage of the cold and snow. Bundle up the kids and head to Central Park for the family snowshoeing and animal tracks and sign foray on Saturday. Wear your winter boots and dress warmly so you can spend a little time in the outdoors as you try your skills at snowshoeing and learn to read animal tracks and sign. You will learn how to identify several animals by their tracks alone and deduce what they were doing from the tracks and sign they left behind. Families will need to sign up for either the morning session from 10 a.m. to noon or the afternoon session from 1 to 3. Space is limited. Contact the Jones County Naturalist at 319-481-7987 to register your family and reserve snowshoes. Don't forget to bring a thermos of hot chocolate and some cups and a snack so you can warm up at your car following snowshoeing. Participants will meet outside of the lower level of the Central Park Nature Center. And in Jackson County, learn about owls of Iowa with live virtual events. The Jackson County Conservation is hosting two events focusing on owls, one virtual and one physical. The virtual event takes place at 6 p.m. February 2, when participants can virtually join Jackson County Conservation Naturalist Tony Vorwald to learn about Iowa's native owl species and their natural history. This free program will be held virtually via Zoom. Participants must register 24 hours in advance, and a Zoom invitation will be sent to you to register. To register or for more information, please email Vorwald at tony@jacksonccb.com or call the Hurstville Interpretive Center. That number is 563-652-3783. A chance to visit and interact with the owls takes place at 6 p.m. February 5 at Maquoketa Cave State Park in the lower shelter. Join naturalist Jenny Meyer in learning how to identify local owls by sound. Take a walk in the woods along the Raccoon Creek Valley Trail at the park and try calling for owls. All ages are welcome. Participants are encouraged to wear masks and dress warmly. There will not be restroom facilities available. For more information or to register, email jacksonccb.com or call 563-652-3783 48 hours before the event. And in our final community story, I won't have time to read the whole story, but at a glance, I'll let you know that there is a sensory trail for adaptive horseback riding designed especially for children with autism and sensory processing challenges. This has been created by Marie Bruns of Cedar Rapids for her Girl Scout Gold Award project. The activity is being created at Inspiration Stables, which is located at 30234 East Worthington Road in Worthington. And information is available online at inspirationstables.org/sensorytrail. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS for today. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at the iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.